Apologies to anyone who is expecting Mike O'Sullivan here this morning, but following the fire in the Cork Church, Mike felt it important that he stay with us and support the congregation in Cork. He's doing services live on the webcam, but they're from his house. In case anyone hasn't heard, the church in Cork had a serious fire on the 28th, 29th of January. One of the things about our denomination is that we have a terrific and proud history, but that history brings responsibility, and one is the care of old buildings, and Cork was one such building. So this morning I thought we might like to share a bit of the history of the Cork congregation with you, and I've called the address The Hand of History. I have spent many years doing my family tree, tracing it back, and it's not one of those families who are very rich, so I'm lucky enough to get back to the 1830s, end of story. But one of the strands of the family, one sometime great-great-something grandmother, married in 1820, and that couple lived two fields apart, and they were not big 100-acre fields, they were small fields. Their children went on, their daughter went on to marry, and that couple lived 2 miles apart. And by the time they got to my parents, they lived about 6 miles apart. So maybe my family history has something to do with my mental outlook. But I always thought that back in the 18th, 19th century, that Ireland was a very small, inward-looking country. But looking at the history of Cork, I realised that it was much more outward-looking than I had ever thought. The church in Cork was built in 1770. That community was very outward-looking. The congregation, before building of this new church in 1710, it started, had a meeting house that seated 400, and they outgrew that space, which is just unimaginable in this day and age. And in 1707, the congregation was strong enough to support a second minister. And we know from their records that the congregation's first choice was someone called Reverend William Gray. And he was a minister in the Presbytery of Derry. Even today, I don't think of Cork and Derry as being well connected. How did the Corkonians in 1707 know that Mr. William Gray was a marvellous minister and that they would like to have him as their minister in Cork? Now, either fortunately or unfortunately, Mr. Gray turned down the offer of it. But that relationship with Cork and the northern churches continued on. And Cork was very, as I said, a very outward-looking place. Rory Delaney tells me that the mantra in Cork is they do things differently. And in 1802, they were the very first Presbyterian church to install an organ in the church. And the northerners thought that this invention of people singing hymns in church with an organ wasn't quite kosher. And they sent missionaries to Cork in 1820. The missionaries caused great offence because they didn't ask permission from the minister. They just went in and held a meeting and said, you know, this wasn't on, having your organ and all of that. But I'm just fascinated of that close connection between Northern Ireland and Cork right in the 1700s and into the 1800s. And they were into discussing new ideas, and they had liberal theology. It was such a vibrant congregation that they outgrew the old meeting house. The new meeting house was built to seat 800 people. And in the 1820s, they had two schools, and alms houses, plural, they ran those as well. And they were very involved in the civic and public life of Cork. The late 1700s and early 1800s were maybe Cork's golden age. They were served by ministers of enormous academic ability. There was a Reverend Thomas Dix Hinks, and he was a minister. His son William became minister, and then his grandson Thomas also became minister there. So there were three generations from one family who served as ministers in Cork, serving this congregation of 800 people. The amazing thing about them was how gifted that family were as academics, because in addition to ministering to 800 people, family members were involved in the deciphering of cuneiform handwriting. One of the sons was one of three people who deciphered Persian cuneiform handwriting. One was professor of classics at the Belfast Academy, and the other one held the chair of natural science in UCC when it opened. The other guy who didn't join the church went off to Canada, the province of Canada. He ended up becoming premier of the province of Canada, Barbados and Guyana. An amazing, well-abled family. Michael Sullivan did some research on the history of that family. They had these brilliant sons who were such high achievers. There were two daughters in the family as well, and the only information about the two daughters is the days of their deaths. Not another word about the women, whether they were good, bad, intelligent, did they even learn to read? And Cork was well aware and involved in the social issues of the day. In 1818, their minister, who was then Reverend Hort, baptized, and there's a note beside this baptism, it says, a freed Negro woman. Her name was Catherine MacDonald, which is a very Irish or Scottish name. And Catherine was about 30 years of age. And again, it just said of her, she was taken from her country of Aboo, A-B-O-O, in West Africa about the age of 9, and taken to Belize. And then in 1816, she's been baptized in the church in Cork. And we have no idea of how did Catherine make her way to Cork. How did she become free? What was her story? And that involvement in slavery and looking after freed slaves continued. Between the years 1845 and 1847, the escaped American slave Frederick Douglass traveled and lectured against slavery in England and Ireland. He's quite a renowned person if anyone wanted to Google him. When he escaped slavery, he fell in love with a black woman who was free herself, and they had 5 children. And when he managed to escape and he began lecturing for the anti-slavery movement in America. And Frederick Douglass was so well spoken and so well read and so well presented that the audience began to say, this man couldn't possibly be a slave. So to prove his credentials, he published a biography. In this first biography, he did 3 over his lifetime, but in his first biography, he gave details of his life, of where he was born, who owned him, and how he escaped. And so he was in danger of being recaptured and sent back to slavery, and he had to leave America. And he left shortly after the birth of one of his children. And he was away between 1845 to 1847. He sailed over to Liverpool and then came to Ireland. And his story and journey in Ireland is very interesting. Frederick Douglass began to learn to read when he was a slave child working in a household of a nice, he was well cared for in childhood. But the family, the mum in the family, the wife, she started to teach him his letters, thinking it would be nice if he could read the Bible. And he soaked this information up. When her husband heard about it, he absolutely exploded and forbid her to continue. But he secretly learned, taught himself with any written material he could get. And that's how he was literate and able to speak at these anti-slavery meetings. And he came first to Belfast and then Dublin and then down to Cork. And it's very interesting. When he came to Dublin, he stayed with a Quaker family in Dublin. When he went to Cork, he stayed with a couple. And he arrived in Cork in the autumn of 1845, and he ended up there staying 6 weeks. While he was there, he stayed with the Jennings family, Mr. James Jennings. And James Jennings was a soda water manufacturer in Cork, and he was a member of Cork Unitarian Church. Jennings' business partner was a Richard Dowden, and Dowden was also a member of the Cork Church. Dowden was also Lord Mayor of Cork. James Jennings' wife was the secretary of the Cork Anti-Slavery Society. And it was reported down in Cork that when Douglas spoke in public, the attendance of ladies at the events soared. He was so handsome. And membership of the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society rocketed when Mr. Douglas came to Cork. I love the ideas of all the ladies going to listen to him. When he was leaving Cork, on behalf of the people of Cork, the Richard Dowden, who was member of Cork, presented Douglas with a gold signet ring. And Douglas wrote of his time in Cork and in Ireland. I can say I have spent the happiest moments of my life. Since landing in this country, I have undergone a transformation. I have a new life. Instead of the bright blue skies of America, I am covered with the soft grey fog of the Emerald Isle. I breathe and lo, the chattel becomes a man. And he called Ireland the Emerald Isle. And the first person to call Ireland was the Emerald Isle was Drennan, William Drennan. And William Drennan was a member here in Dublin. It's all these little connections. While Douglas was in Cork, he met the great temperance priest, Father Theobald Matthew, and he took the pledge from Father Matthew. But they had a falling out later on when Father Matthew went to America to preach in favor of temperance, because he began to describe alcoholism as equivalent to slavery, and Douglas felt that that was just not a reality. He said, you can be a drunk, but you can marry who you want, you can move away, you can get a job. And they fell out over that. And supporting and against Father Matthew speaking like that, comparing slavery to alcoholism, Mr. Houghton, William Houghton, is it, Rory? James Houghton. James Houghton, who was head of the anti-slavery movement in Dublin, wrote to tell Father Matthew off about this as well. And James Houghton was the first trustee of this building. So you have all of these connections with Dublin, Cork, the North, spreading around. It is like a spider's web. In 1847, And the story is very gets really interesting at the end. In 1847, Douglas was safe for him to return to America in the knowledge he could not be rearrested and sent back as a slave. And that was because a Mrs. Anna Richardson of Newcastle in England purchased Douglas's legal freedom from his owner. And this is what the note of the agreement for this purchase of his freedom, which is such a terrible expression to use. I will take £150 sterling for the manumission of my slave, Frederick Bailey, alias Douglas. I am prepared to give such papers or deed of manumission as will forever exempt him from any claim by any person or persons. In other words, the paper will render him entirely and legally free. Douglas and Mrs. Jennings of Cork maintained a lifelong friendship through correspondence. Mrs. Richardson, Anna, who purchased Douglas's freedom, was a Quaker living in Newcastle, and her sister was Mrs. Jennings in Cork. I just loved that happy bookend on that story. In 1845, Douglas wrote of his delight about finding in Ireland the absence of any prejudice against me because of the colour of my skin. He said that was the first time he ever felt that the colour of his skin did not matter. And it is lovely to read that Ireland was so welcoming of Douglas that for the first time, skin colour was irrelevant. But now I wondered, what if Frederick Douglass how he would be treated if he were to come to Ireland today in 2024? Would the colour of his skin be ignored? Would he be welcomed? That's a thumbnail sketch of Ireland in the mid-1850s. And the Cork's Unitarian contribution to the anti-slavery movement and to the community around them. It was a vibrant congregation engaged in practical social activism. And maybe it was the high point for the church in Cork. In the early years of this century, it was almost defunct and the church was in dreadful condition. In 2017, Mike O'Sullivan was appointed minister in Cork. And Mike has worked ceaselessly to rebuild the congregation and as far as possible to restore the building. It was just last autumn that we celebrated the completion of a dedicated workspace, one that was warm, bright, welcoming and clean. And I went down for that and it was such a lovely time to walk into a space that was their worship space. I had taken services in that church, as has Jennifer Flegg, in all sorts of conditions at one time there was a bicycle fair on in Cork and I was surrounded by antique bicycles. There was even a wooden bicycle in that Sunday there around me and I'm in the middle with a few people there to listen. So it was really, really, I felt on the up. In the past, since the fire, the council have been in discussion with Mike about the possibility, just before the fire, first of all, the council had been in discussion with Mike about the possibility of using the courtyard space behind the church to commemorate Douglas's visit to Cork. There's a lovely courtyard space and behind the Cork Church, their plan was to plaster the walls. There would be two murals painted on the walls, and the agreement was, we said, yes, you can do that, provided you landscape the gardens all around the church, which they agreed to do. And there was an ad in the Times for this artistic competition to paint the murals. It was really on the up. There was 10,000 the council were spending on this. So everything seemed to be optimistic that Cork would be more on the map. You know, the council were getting involved in cleaning the front of the place. And then the fire, and that's changed everything. Cork don't have the use of their church building now. It is unusable at present. There's no longer a stream of income from hiring the church. They were getting some income. It was used for concerts, and everyone who held a concert there remarked on the fabulous acoustics of the place. And the Cork congregation is at a crossroads. The decisions made in the days and weeks ahead will define the very future of the church. Do they try and raise funds in the hope of restoring the building? Do they sell it and buy another building or place of worship, leaving behind a history of more than 300 years? They have had offers of places where they can take services. The Quakers, the Church of Ireland have been generous. The gay community in Cork have offered them their office space. And they have an offer now of a disused courthouse for a year, which is looking promising. If they went with the Church of Ireland or the Quakers, it would mean having their service at 9:30 in the morning or 4:00 in the evening. And that really wouldn't suit the Cork Church. You know, when you're into the habit of 11:00 on a Sunday, it's very hard to come at 4:00. So that's where they're at the moment. And the question, I think, for the Dublin congregation is, do we help a sister church, or to what extent do we help them? You know, what would really benefit them would be, they're going to form a committee to look for their way forward. But if people with sort of experience of being on committees and outside voices would agree to join the Cork committee to offer any expertise they have in property, in even just giving them an outside opinion on their situation, it would be really, really good. If there were quantity surveyors or architects looking for a marvellous project to work on, you know, and it wouldn't mean going to Cork, it would mean working via Zoom. But I throw these things out, and I know it's a huge ask. I know that people here are really good about supporting this church, and I know the amount of support we need to keep this place going. But I'm putting it out there, and it goes to anyone who's listening. And I'm putting it out with faith, hope, and ridiculous optimism. I've always been optimistic about Cork, and I refuse to give that up. We'll watch this space. I don't quite expect a congregation of 800 again, but I'm optimistic. Amen.